A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. It's a question that sounds almost absurd when you say it out loud. What is Mar-a-Lago? And how did a private resort and golf club become an unofficial center of American government? He's asking about the structural weirdness of it, the qualitative difference from something like Camp David, and why this particular property has been so central to decision-making across both Trump presidencies.
The image that captures the whole thing is this. Imagine a president receiving a nuclear briefing on a poolside patio while club members in swimsuits wander past on their way to the buffet. That's not a hypothetical.
You've got foreign leaders being hosted for state dinners in the same ballroom where someone's wedding reception was booked the following weekend. Cabinet secretaries getting fired between courses. The nuclear football. The actual nuclear football. Sitting somewhere near the dessert station.
The initiation fee to join this club was $200,000 as of 2023. Annual dues run about $14,000. So you're paying for access to a facility where, on any given weekend, the President of the United States might be conducting foreign policy from the next table over.
Which raises the question, are you paying for a golf membership, or are you paying for proximity to power? And if it's both, what does that mean for how the country is governed?
No other democracy has seen anything like this. Heads of government have retreats, they have vacation homes. But a for-profit business owned by the sitting president, where foreign governments spend money, where political donors gather, where classified briefings happen in spaces that are also open to dues. Paying members, that's not a retreat. That's a structural anomaly.
The anomaly didn't end when the first term did. If anything, the post-presidency phase made it stranger. The club became a campaign headquarters, a media studio, a policy shop, and, for a stretch, the site of an FBI search warrant executed on a former president's home to recover classified documents. 11,000 of them.
The question Daniel's asking isn't just, what's the history of this building? It's, how did the American constitutional system produce this situation? What made it possible? And what does it tell us about the gap between how the presidency was designed and how it actually operates?
To answer that, you have to start with the building itself, because Mar-a-Lago wasn't built to be a seat of power. It was built to be a winter palace for a serial heiress who wanted to throw the best parties in Palm Beach.
Marjorie Meriwether Post. She built it between 1924 and 1927. 126 rooms, 62,500 square feet, sitting on 17 acres between the Atlantic Ocean and the Intracoastal Waterway. That's roughly the size of the White House multiplied by 1.5. And she built it as a seasonal home.
Post was the daughter of C. Post, who founded the Postum Cereal Company, which later became General Foods. She inherited the business at 27 and became one of the wealthiest women in America. When she built Mar-a-Lago, she imported 3 shiploads of Dorian stone from Genoa. She brought in Spanish tiles, Italian marble, a 75-foot tower. The architect was Marion Sims Wyeth, but the interiors were done by Joseph Urban, a Viennese set designer who'd worked on Broadway productions. The whole thing has this theatrical quality, which is fitting given what it eventually became.
Post died in 1973 and willed the property to the U government, hoping it would become a presidential retreat, a sort of winter White House for future presidents. The government accepted it in 1972, actually, before she died, but by 1981, they gave it back. The annual upkeep was estimated at $1 million a year in early 80s money. That's about $3 million today. Congress passed a bill returning it to the Post Foundation. It sat largely unused, was listed for sale at $20 million, and nobody bit. Until 1985, when Donald Trump bought it for about $10 million, furnishings included.
Which was a bargain even then. He negotiated the asking price down from $20 million.
He converted it to a private club in 1995. And that's the pivot point. It stopped being just a mansion and became a business. Initiation fees, annual dues, event rentals, a spa, tennis courts, a beach club.
which is what makes the presidential era so structurally different from any previous retreat. Camp David is a naval support facility in Maryland, operated by the U-Navy, paid for with appropriations. The president doesn't own it. The president doesn't profit from it. When LBJ went to his Texas ranch, he owned it, but it wasn't a commercial enterprise with paying customers. Same with Reagan's Rancho del Cielo. It was a private home, not a club with members.
Mar-a-Lago is a going concern. During Trump's first term, he spent 142 days there per CNN's tracking. That's about 20% of his presidency. And each visit wasn't just the president relocating. The entire apparatus moved with him. National Security Council staff, military aides, communications teams, the Secret Service, all descending on Palm Beach. The club stayed open to members during these visits. So you'd have a situation where the president is in the dining room, members are eating dinner 30 feet away, and somewhere nearby there's a CIF, a sensitive compartmented information facility, set up in a converted space for classified briefings.
A CIF in a beach club. That's not a sentence you encounter in the Federalist Papers.
The White House Communications Agency had to install secure communications lines. The military aides carrying the nuclear football had to be accommodated somewhere on the property. Staff worked out of converted guest rooms and ballrooms. The logistics were enormous and enormously expensive.
Palm Beach itself had to adapt. The town imposed flight restrictions during presidential visits, closing the airport to general aviation. The Coast Guard patrolled the waterways. The Secret Service rented nearby homes and boats for security perimeters. Local businesses lost weeks of revenue during each extended visit because road closures and checkpoints made the area difficult to access.
All of this was happening at a property where the president was the sole or principal owner. The Trump Organization managed the club. Members paid dues, events were booked, foreign diplomats stayed there. Which brings us to the Emoluments Clause.
Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. No person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state.
The word emolument sounds archaic, but it means any payment, fee, or profit. When a foreign government rents space at Mar-a-Lago for an event, or when foreign diplomats stay at the club and pay for rooms and services, that's money flowing from a foreign state to a business owned by the president. Multiple lawsuits were filed, one by the attorneys general of D.C., Maryland, another by a group of congressional Democrats. But none of them reached a definitive Supreme Court ruling before the 2020 election. After the election, the cases were largely dismissed as moot, so we still don't have a clear judicial interpretation of whether the Emoluments Clause applies to commercial transactions at a president's business. The constitutional question is unresolved.
Which is itself a kind of precedent. If the clause isn't enforced, future presidents will know that.
The most vivid example of the blurring happened in April 2017. Trump hosted Chinese President Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago for what was billed as a summit. During the dinner, Trump received word that a Syrian airbase had been used to launch a chemical weapons attack. He convened his national security team at the table, and from that dinner, he authorized a Tomahawk missile strike on the airbase. The decision was made at Mar-a-Lago while the Chinese president was still on the property.
There's a photograph from that dinner. Trump and Xi are seated at a long table in the club's dining room. National security staff are huddled nearby. Other diners are visible in the background. The president is ordering a military strike, and club members are eating their entrees. That image captures the whole phenomenon. The most consequential decisions of the presidency being made in a space that is, simultaneously, a restaurant.
Then in 2019, Trump proposed hosting the 2020 G7 summit at Mar-a-Lago. The leaders of the world's largest economies would convene at a for-profit resort owned by the U. Their governments would pay the Trump Organization for accommodations, meeting spaces, and services. The constitutional implications were so obvious that the backlash was immediate and bipartisan. The plan was abandoned within days.
The fact that it was proposed at all tells you something about the normalization that had already occurred. By year three of the first term, the idea of foreign governments directly paying the president's business for a diplomatic summit was considered plausible enough to float publicly.
Then the presidency ended, or at least the first term did, and the weirdness didn't stop. It just changed form. After January 2021, Mar-a-Lago became Trump's primary residence and the operational headquarters of his political operation. The club hosted fundraisers, donor retreats, strategy sessions for the 2022 midterms and the 2024 campaign.
It became the site of the first FBI search of a former president's home in American history. In January 2022, the National Archives retrieved 15 boxes of documents from Mar-a-Lago, some of which were marked classified. The Justice Department opened an investigation. On August 8, 2022, the FBI executed a search warrant and recovered 11,000 documents, more than 100 of which were marked classified, including some at the highest classification levels.
These documents were stored at various locations around the club: a ballroom, a bathroom, a storage room, spaces that were accessible to club staff, members, and guests. The national security implications of that are hard to overstate. We're talking about documents whose classification markings indicated they contained information that could cause exceptionally grave damage to national security if disclosed.
You have this building that has served, at various points, as a Gilded Age mansion, a private club, a de facto West Wing, a campaign headquarters, a media studio, a policy shop, and a crime scene. All while continuing to operate as a business with dues-paying members who swim in the pool and eat in the dining room.
By 2024, it was routine for presidential candidates, foreign leaders, and media figures to make the pilgrimage to Palm Beach. Viktor Orban visited. Javier Milei visited. Benjamin Netanyahu visited. The club had become a kind of parallel diplomatic venue. If you wanted to engage with the Republican Party's leader and likely nominee, you went to Mar-a-Lago.
Which creates a structural question that the American system hasn't answered. When a former president, and then a president again, operates from a for-profit business, the lines between public governance and private enterprise don't just blur. Staff who work at Mar-a-Lago are simultaneously serving the presidency and the Trump Organization. Foreign policy meetings happen in spaces where other patrons are present. Who has access? Who's in the room? What records are kept?
The Presidential Records Act requires that records of official business be preserved, but enforcing that in a private club where the president's personal and official lives are intermingled in real time is extraordinarily difficult. The classified documents case demonstrated exactly how easily the boundaries can break down.
The question Daniel's asking, how did we end up here, has layers. There's the physical layer, 126 rooms, 62,000 square feet, bought for $10 million, converted to a club. There's the operational layer, the SIF in the converted ballroom, the nuclear football by the pool, the staff working from guest rooms. There's the legal layer, the emoluments clause, the Presidential Records Act, the classified documents investigation. And then there's the systemic layer. What does it mean for a democracy when the seat of government is also a revenue-generating asset?
That's what we should trace through the rest of this episode. The mechanism, the aftermath, and what it means for the presidency going forward. Because this isn't just about one building or one president. It's about whether the institutional norms that have governed the office can survive a model where governance and private business are the same thing.
Let's start with the operational reality. How does a private club physically function as a command center? What actually has to happen for the presidency to relocate to Palm Beach?
The building itself. 126 rooms across 62,500 square feet. To put that in perspective, the White House residence is about 55,000 square feet. Mar-a-Lago is larger, and it was built as a single family's winter home. Post spared no expense. 3 shiploads of Dorian stone from Genoa, Spanish tiles throughout, a 75-foot tower. The interiors were done by Joseph Urban, a Viennese set designer who'd worked on Broadway productions. So the whole thing has this theatrical, almost stage-set quality, which, in retrospect, is remarkably on the nose.
A set designer designing what would become the set for an entire era of American politics. Sometimes history doesn't do subtle.
Post named it Mar-a-Lago, Spanish for sea to lake, because the property stretches from the Atlantic Ocean on one side to the Intracoastal Waterway on the other. She used it as a seasonal home for decades, hosting charity galas and society events. Palm Beach in the 20s and 30s was the winter playground of the American elite, and Mar-a-Lago was its crown jewel.
Then in 1972, she did something interesting. She willed it to the federal government, hoping it would become a winter White House. The government accepted it. The National Park Service designated it a National Historic Landmark in 1980.
Then gave it back.
Which is the part that always gets me. Government-owned Mar-a-Lago. It was theirs, and they handed it back because the maintenance was too expensive.
About $1 million a year in early 80s money. Congress passed a bill returning it to the Post Foundation in 1981. Nobody wanted to buy it at the $20 million asking price. It sat empty for years, deteriorating. Then, in 1985, Trump bought it for roughly $10 million, furnishings included.
The government had a presidential retreat, decided it cost too much to keep, sold it back to a private foundation, and then a private citizen bought it for half the asking price. Fast forward 3 decades, and that same private citizen is president, using it as a retreat anyway, and the government is now paying millions per visit for security and logistics. The fiscal efficiency of this is remarkable.
But the key institutional moment is 1995, when Trump converted it from a private residence to a private club. That's the structural shift that makes everything that followed possible. A private home is one thing. A business with 500 members, initiation fees, annual dues, event rentals, a spa, tennis courts, that's a different legal entity entirely.
500 members, each paying a $200,000 initiation fee as of 2023, plus annual dues of about $14,000. That's somewhere north of $100 million in initiation fees alone, just from the membership roster. Before you even get to event revenue, food and beverage, or anything else.
Here's where the institutional question sharpens. Camp David is a naval support facility. The president goes there, the Navy runs it, Congress appropriates the funding. There's no profit motive, there's no membership roster. When LBJ went to his Texas ranch, he owned the land, but it wasn't a commercial enterprise with paying customers wandering through.
Mar-a-Lago inverted that. The president was operating from a business he owned, and that business stayed open during his visits. Members kept coming. Events kept being booked. The dining room where the president ate dinner was the same dining room where members ate dinner. The ballroom where he held press conferences was the same ballroom where weddings were held.
Which brings us to the transformation in scale. By April 2017, 4 months into the first term, Mar-a-Lago was hosting a formal bilateral summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping. 2 days of meetings, a state dinner, joint statements, the full apparatus of a presidential summit conducted at a private club. And during that dinner, Trump ordered the Tomahawk missile strike on the Shayrat airbase in Syria. The decision was made at the table. National security staff huddled around him. The Chinese president was still on the property. Club members were eating nearby.
Then, in 2019, the G7 proposal. Hosting the leaders of Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the United Kingdom at a for-profit resort owned by the sitting president. Their governments would have paid the Trump Organization directly for rooms, meals, meeting spaces, and services. The emoluments clause implications were so glaring that the plan collapsed within days of being floated. But the fact that it was floated at all tells you how far the normalization had already progressed.
The post-presidency phase took it even further. After January 2021, Mar-a-Lago became Trump's primary residence and the operational headquarters of his political operation. Fundraisers, donor retreats, strategy sessions for the midterms and the 2024 campaign. Foreign leaders began making the pilgrimage: Viktor Orban, Javier Milei, Benjamin Netanyahu. If you wanted to engage with the Republican Party's leader, you went to Palm Beach.
Then, the classified documents investigation. The National Archives retrieved 15 boxes in January 2022. The FBI search warrant in August of that year recovered 11,000 documents, more than 100 marked classified, some at the highest levels. These were stored in a ballroom, a bathroom, a storage room, spaces accessible to club staff and members. The first search of a former president's home in American history, and that home was a private club with paying customers.
The arc is this. A Gilded Age mansion becomes a private club, becomes a de facto West Wing, becomes a campaign, headquarters becomes a crime scene. And through all of it, the club kept operating. Members kept swimming. Dues kept getting paid. The fundamental question, How does a private business become a seat of government isn't just about logistics. It's about what happens to the boundaries between public service and private profit when the president lives and works inside his own revenue stream.
Let's walk through what it actually took to relocate the presidency. The first thing to understand is that when the president travels, a piece of the executive branch travels with him. It's not just staff with laptops. It's the nuclear football, carried by a military aide who stays within visual range of the president at all times.
Which at Mar-a-Lago meant that aide was standing somewhere near the pool deck or the dining room while members ordered cocktails. The football, officially the presidential emergency satchel, contains the authentication codes and strike options for nuclear launch. It's never more than a few dozen feet from the president. At the White House, that's routine. At a private club, it means the officer carrying it is navigating around wedding planners and golf carts.
That's just one piece of hardware. What else moves?
The White House Communications Agency installs a full secure communications suite. Encrypted phones, video conferencing, classified computer networks. At Mar-a-Lago, they had to retrofit existing rooms, ballrooms, guest suites, into temporary operations centers. The SCIF, the Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, is a room built to block electronic surveillance. At the White House, there are multiple permanent SCIFs. At Mar-a-Lago, they had to construct a temporary one.
A temporary SCIF in a building that's also hosting brunch service.
It's not cheap. Each presidential visit to Mar-a-Lago costs taxpayers an estimated $3 to $4 million, according to the Government Accountability Office. That's transportation for staff, security perimeters, communications infrastructure, Coast Guard patrols. Multiply that by the 142 days Trump spent there during the first term, and you're looking at a substantial line item.
Palm Beach County estimated they spent over $60 million on overtime and logistics for presidential visits during the first term alone. The federal government reimbursed some of it, but not all. Local taxpayers absorbed the rest.
The airport closure was a particular pain point. Palm Beach International sits just across the Intracoastal from Mar-a-Lago. When the president was in residence, the FAA imposed a 30-mile no-fly zone and shut down the airport to general aviation. Flight schools, charter operators, private planes, all grounded. The economic impact on those businesses ran into the millions.
The Secret Service presence transformed the neighborhood. They rented nearby properties for staging and surveillance. They deployed boats in the Intracoastal and the Atlantic. They established checkpoints that turned a 10-minute drive into a 40-minute ordeal. Residents complained, businesses lost foot traffic, and the town had to negotiate reimbursement with the federal government after each extended stay.
Here's the structural twist. All of this government spending, the security, the communications, the logistics, was flowing into and around a business owned by the president. The Secret Service wasn't just protecting the president. It was protecting a revenue-generating asset. The club continued to operate, which meant members continued to arrive, and those members were being screened by Secret Service alongside club staff.
Those members had access. If you were a member in good standing, you could be on the property while the president was there. You might not get into the CIF, but you could be in the dining room, on the terrace, at the pool. The proximity was part of the product.
Which is exactly where the Emoluments Clause becomes more than a constitutional abstraction. Article 1, Section 9 is short, one sentence, but the implications for Mar-a-Lago were specific. When the Embassy of Kuwait held its National Day celebration at the club in 2017, that was a foreign government paying the president's business. When a Chinese delegation stayed there, same thing. When the Japanese Prime Minister visited and his staff booked rooms, same thing.
The lawsuits tried to establish that these transactions violated the clause, and Maryland attorneys general argued that foreign governments were effectively currying favor by directing business to the president's property. Both cases established standing and survived initial motions to dismiss, which was itself significant. Courts were willing to hear the argument.
They never reached a final merits ruling. The Fourth Circuit ruled that the congressional plaintiffs lacked standing. Circuit and Second Circuit cases were pending when the 2020 election happened, and after Trump left office, the Supreme Court directed lower courts to dismiss them as moot. So the constitutional question, does the Emoluments Clause apply to commercial transactions at a president's business, remains unanswered.
Which means a future president could look at that track record and conclude, reasonably, that the clause has no practical teeth. If you can run out the clock on litigation through a 4-year term, the precedent is effectively set by default.
The G7 proposal in 2019 showed how far that thinking had already gone. Hosting the world's largest economies at your own resort, having their governments pay your business directly, that wasn't a fringe idea whispered in a hallway. It was announced by the White House press secretary. Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, defended it on television. The only reason it died was the bipartisan backlash, not any internal legal review.
The backlash was swift enough that even Republicans on the Hill said no. And that's the other piece of this. The institutional guardrails functioned in that instance, but they functioned through political pressure, not constitutional enforcement. If the political pressure hadn't materialized, there was no automatic mechanism to stop it.
That gets to the core of why Mar-a-Lago is different from every previous presidential retreat. Camp David is owned by the government. The president can't monetize it. The LBJ Ranch, Reagan's Rancho del Cielo, the Bush compound in Kennebunkport, those were private homes, not commercial enterprises. The president wasn't collecting fees from members while conducting official business.
Mar-a-Lago combined the two functions in a way that the system had never had to contend with. The president was simultaneously the head of state and the proprietor of the venue where state business was conducted. Every foreign leader who visited, every diplomat who attended an event, every donor who booked a fundraiser, they were all, in some sense, customers.
That dynamic didn't end with the first term. If anything, the post-presidency phase amplified it. After January 2021, Trump's primary residence was Mar-a-Lago. The club became the physical center of gravity for the Republican Party in a way no private residence has ever been for a major American political party. Donor retreats during the 2024 cycle charged $250,000 per person for access. That's not a campaign contribution, or it is, but it's also a transaction at a private club. The line between the two is impossible to draw cleanly.
Foreign leaders started making the pilgrimage. Viktor Orban of Hungary visited. Javier Milei of Argentina visited right after his election. Benjamin Netanyahu came. These weren't social calls. They were diplomatic meetings with the Republican frontrunner, held at his private club, with all the optics and access questions that implies.
The normalization effect is what's striking. By 2024, nobody in the political press treated it as unusual that a presidential candidate was conducting foreign policy meetings from a resort where membership cost $200,000. It had become the expected venue. If you wanted FaceTime with Trump, you went to Mar-a-Lago. The club had evolved into a parallel diplomatic channel, a campaign headquarters, and a media studio, all while continuing to operate as a business with dues-paying members.
Those members were still there, still eating dinner, still on the property while the former president, and then president again, held meetings with foreign leaders and political operatives. The question of who has access becomes unanswerable in any formal sense, because the membership roster is private.
The classified documents investigation crystallized the stakes. In January 2022, the National Archives retrieved 15 boxes from Mar-a-Lago. Some contained materials marked classified. The Justice Department opened an investigation. On August 8, 2022, the FBI executed a search warrant, the first search of a former president's residence in American history. They recovered 11,000 documents. More than 100 were marked classified, including some at the highest classification levels.
These weren't in a secure vault. They were in a ballroom, a bathroom, a storage room, spaces accessible to club staff, maintenance workers, members, and guests. Documents whose classification markings indicated they contained information that could cause exceptionally grave damage to national security, sitting in a storage room at a beach club.
The Presidential Records Act requires that records of official business be preserved and eventually transferred to the National Archives. But enforcing that in a private club, where the president's personal life and official duties are intermingled in real time, is extraordinarily difficult. The classified documents case demonstrated exactly how easily the boundaries can break down. And it raised a question that the system still hasn't answered. What records exist from meetings held at Mar-a-Lago? Who decides what's official and what's personal when the venue is both?
That's the governance problem in miniature. When a president operates from a for-profit business, the staff who work there are simultaneously serving the presidency and the Trump Organization. A club employee who sets up a meeting room, Are they a hospitality worker or a presidential staffer? What security clearances do they have? What records do they keep?
When foreign policy meetings happen in spaces where other patrons are present, the entire concept of a confidential diplomatic conversation gets fuzzy. At the White House, access is controlled. At Camp David, it's a military facility. At Mar-a-Lago, the member at the next table might overhear a discussion about trade policy or military deployments. The club's privacy policy isn't the same thing as national security protocol.
There's an international comparison worth making, because it sharpens what's unique about the American case. Silvio Berlusconi in Italy operated extensively from his private villa, Villa Certosa in Sardinia. He hosted foreign leaders there, including Vladimir Putin and Tony Blair. But Italy's political system has a weaker separation of powers, tradition, and Berlusconi's conflicts of interest were widely criticized as a democratic backsliding symptom.
Putin's Novo Ogaryovo residence outside Moscow is another example, a private-seeming estate that's actually a state property heavily secured where Putin conducts most of his official business. But Russia isn't a democracy with a strong separation of powers. Case is different precisely because the American system was designed with institutional checks that were supposed to prevent exactly this kind of blurring.
The framers wrote the Emoluments Clause for a reason. They'd seen European monarchies where public office and private enrichment were the same thing. They wanted to prevent that. What they didn't anticipate was a president who would operate from a for-profit business while in office, and a Congress that wouldn't enforce the clause.
The Mar-a-Lago model tests whether those institutional norms can survive when a president treats governance as an extension of personal business. And the test isn't hypothetical. It's been running for years now. The club has functioned as a West Wing, a diplomatic venue, a campaign headquarters, and a revenue stream all at once, and the system hasn't developed a clear mechanism for drawing boundaries between those functions.
The question Daniel's asking has an answer that's both concrete and systemic. The concrete answer is the building, the membership fees, the CIF in the converted ballroom, the 142 days, the 11,000 documents. The systemic answer is that the American constitutional system contains a gap where the Emoluments Clause should be, and that gap is large enough to drive a golf cart through.
That gap isn't just a legal curiosity. It's been stress-tested, and the results are in. The Emoluments Clause cases were dismissed as moot. Congress held hearings but passed nothing. The Presidential Records Act proved difficult to enforce in a private club setting. Each of these was a chance for the system to clarify the boundaries, and each time the system essentially shrugged.
Which means the precedent is now baked in. A future president, from either party, can look at the Mar-a-Lago experience and conclude that operating from a for-profit property carries no enforceable legal consequence. The political cost might be high, but only if the opposition controls enough of Congress to make it matter.
Here's the practical framework Daniel's question points toward. When you're evaluating a president's conduct, or a candidate's, don't just listen to what they say about ethics and transparency. Look at where they do the work. The physical location of governance determines who's in the room, what records get kept, and whose interests are being served.
If a meeting happens in the White House, there's a visitor log, there are staffers taking notes, there's a paper trail. If it happens on the terrace at Mar-a-Lago, with club members at the next table and no formal record system, the public may never know it occurred.
The access question is especially concrete. At the White House, the gate is controlled by the Secret Service and the appointment secretary. At a private club, access is controlled by the membership director and the president's personal staff. Those are different filters serving different masters.
The framework for listeners is simple. Three questions to ask about any president's working location. Who has access? What records are being kept? And who profits from the transaction? If you can't answer those three questions clearly, the boundary between public service and private enterprise has already blurred.
Which brings us to the ultimate institutional question. Should the presidency require divestiture of all for-profit properties? Some democracies do this. But the American system has relied on norms rather than statutes, the assumption being that presidents would voluntarily separate themselves from their businesses.
That assumption held more or less until it didn't. And once it didn't, there was no statutory backstop. Congress could pass a law requiring divestiture or blind trusts with genuine independence. But Congress hasn't, and the political incentives to do so are weak when the party controlling the legislature is the president's own.
The alternative argument is that transparency and political accountability are enough that voters can judge whether a president's business entanglements cross a line, and that the remedy is electoral. But that argument depends on voters having complete information about what's happening inside the club. And by definition, a private club doesn't provide that.
The Mar-a-Lago phenomenon isn't just a story about one building or one president. It's a stress test that revealed a structural weakness in the constitutional architecture. The framers gave us a clause to prevent foreign payments to officials. They didn't give us a clear mechanism to enforce it, and they didn't anticipate a president who would treat the office as an extension of a hospitality brand.
That's the question that hangs over the whole thing. Mar-a-Lago isn't just a building. It's a stress test of whether the American constitutional system can handle a president who operates entirely outside the institutional norms that have governed the office for two centuries. The test has been running for a decade now, and the results are mixed at best.
The system caught some things. The G7 proposal died. The Emoluments Clause lawsuits established that courts would at least hear the argument, even if they never ruled on the merits. But the larger structural question, can a president govern from a for-profit business without corrupting the office? That one got punted.
Punting is itself a form of precedent. If a future president owns a hotel chain, or a resort, or a media company, and decides to conduct official business from those properties, there's now a track record that says the legal system probably won't stop them. Congress might not either, especially if the president's party controls the chamber.
The Mar-a-Lago model is replicable. That's the part that should focus the mind. You don't need 126 rooms and a Gilded Age pedigree. You need a property you own, a revenue stream it generates, and a willingness to blur the line between governing and doing business. The infrastructure that made Mar-a-Lago possible, the SCIF installations, the communications retrofitting, the Secret Service adaptation, that's now a known quantity. The playbook exists.
The question Daniel's prompt implicitly asks is whether Congress will act to close the loophole before the next president from either party decides to use it. The answer, based on recent history, is probably not. Institutional reform in the American system tends to be reactive rather than proactive. Something has to break visibly before anyone fixes it.
The Emoluments Clause has been sitting there since 1789, and we still don't have a definitive Supreme Court interpretation of what it means in the context of a president's business. That's not a drafting problem. That's an enforcement problem. The clause exists. The will to use it doesn't.
We end up back at the image we started with, the nuclear football on a poolside patio. The military aide standing at attention while a member in a bathrobe walks past with a piña colada. The president, phone in hand, authorizing a missile strike between the salad course and the entree.
The question isn't whether that image is strange. It is strange. The question is whether it's a one-off anomaly, a quirk of one particular presidency that future historians will treat as a curiosity, or whether it's the shape of things to come, whether the next president and the one after that will look at the Mar-a-Lago model and see a bug in the system or a feature.
I suspect the answer depends on whether voters decide it matters. The legal architecture for preventing this exists on paper. The political architecture for enforcing it requires a public that treats the blurring of public office and private business as disqualifying. If that norm erodes, the Emoluments Clause is just words on parchment.
That's the open question we're left with. Not whether Mar-a-Lago was an anomaly, but whether it was a preview.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, Aztec Patoli players in the Seychelles scored their throws using resonant coconut shells that produced distinct acoustic tones, a high clack for a 1, a hollow thud for a 5, allowing games.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear holes. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.